Experience new ideas every day with RN.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas. Paul Barclay with you here on RN and on the ABC Radio app, or you may be one of our huge band of podcast listeners. The shooting death of Michael Brown by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in August last year sparked a firestorm of popular anger, frustration, and a degree of hopelessness. Since then, the problem seems only to have gotten worse, with more and more reports of similar instances of police brutality towards young African-American men. The racial tensions ignited in riots in Baltimore in April this year, after yet another death due to police brutality. Why is all this happening now? And what do the problems in the US tell us about our own record on race and police violence? These are some of the questions considered in tonight's discussion, recorded at the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. Thomas Adams is a lecturer in History and American Studies at the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. David Smith is a lecturer in American Politics and Foreign Policy, also at the US Studies Centre. Madeline Pill is a lecturer in Public Policy at the University of Sydney, and Ethan Blue is a senior lecturer in History at the University of Western Australia. Scott Stevens from RN's The Minefield convened this discussion, and his first question was why this issue had become so explosive in the last year.
I don't think that police violence or police killings are getting more frequent. I think that awareness of them is increasing. One of the reasons is because of how much of it is now captured on film. When we remember what a novelty that was 20 years ago that led to the riots in Los Angeles after the beating of Rodney King, that is now commonplace. So there's that. I think that, as you mentioned earlier, particularly the circumstances of the Trayvon Martin case and the fact that that led to mass protests in Florida just in order to get an investigation started, I think that that was the particular event that led to the most recent wave of protests that now accompany black deaths at the hands of police. I think that that event was very important. Like a lot of kind of sudden changes in the social atmosphere, it's often very difficult to predict what kind of events are going to lead to change. In the same way that one self-immolation in Tunisia led to the entire Arab Spring, here there was nothing preordained about the Trayvon Martin case that meant that it would lead to this sudden massive increase in awareness of these kinds of cases. It was a confluence of events. But one of the most important things about it was that it was protests that actually led to an investigation in the first place. Unfortunately, by the time the investigation took place, it was 6 weeks later, and that was too late to be able to secure any evidence that could have led to a conviction. But I think that it did show people right across the United States the power of protest for at least making inroads into achieving justice.
I guess, and with the interest in being somewhat provocative, I guess I would disagree a bit insofar as I think, and you're absolutely correct, right? I think in terms of the fact of film being incredibly important in this. But I think the racialized police brutality of America kind of hits at something that is a kind of longer standing issue, and that is a kind of transformation of, in fact, a kind of American protest politics in general towards what, and again, in the interest of being somewhat provocative, I'll say essentially witness bearing. That is to say, and that witness bearing as protest, I think, is especially easy in regards to a kind of a progressive politics which has more or less cut itself along the lines of racialized inequality as the kind of as the utmost of forms of American social inequality, and it's kind of the pinnacle, right? And it has a long history and a very important history in its relationship to the civil rights movement. But insofar as not only these cases of police brutality, but some of y'all might remember, thinking back, it's 2007, 2008, large national protests over what was essentially a kind of schoolyard fight in Gina, Louisiana, between some white students and some black students. And this was a kind of, again, more evidence of, again, the kind of clear racism of American society. Unfortunately, those examples of clear racism are the ones that are easy to get in the streets around, but are not necessarily the ones that are easy and really kind of necessarily a huge part of changing the conditions that caused them in the first place. So that is to say, the kind of a long emphasis, again, on that kind of witness bearing itself, and again, vis-a-vis kind of racism, I think is what I would argue the somewhat demobilizing nature of that current moment.
So, by witness bearing, you're not just meaning social media campaigns, Black Lives Matter, but also the kind of satellite protests.
I mean, insofar, and I do not, you know, they're frequently justified in what's going to come next, right? And that their evidence, the evidence of their strength of success, of their contestation of political power, is we can't see it yet because it's going to happen next year, or the year after that, or the year after that. But we can look back at, again, in 1992 in Los Angeles. We can look back at pretty much the hundreds of instances of police brutality that have erupted in urban disorders since the 1940s across America. And continually the justification is what's going to happen next justifies this as protest. But in terms of actually kind of putting together any institutional base to demand change, I see none of that. So in that regard, I see this as essentially kind of witness bearing.
I want to come back to that in a second. Yeah.
Well, I think I would have to disagree a little bit as well. I think there has been actual genuine movement building that's been uphill against massive repressive forces, but nonetheless generally being reasonably effective in terms of generating a critique of mass incarceration, to the point where somebody like Hillary Clinton is talking about mass incarceration. Now, whether or not this is a capture of the critical development of the critique of contemporary racism and as it links to deindustrialization. But there's been a long-standing movement, a simmering movement, at times quite vibrant movement, among prisoners, among the family members of prisoners, that's really been involved in doing its best to do institution building. But this, of course, is in the face of a massively repressive state apparatus that is not afraid to repress, to divide and conquer, to imprison. And so I think, I mean, you can look at the critical resistance movements that have sprung up. And I mean, a lot of these are prisoner-led, prisoner-theorized. And so I think what we're seeing here is, you know, the coming together of the social media, the video cameras, everybody's got a video phone, right? But then I like to think that a lot of the critical work that activists and some scholars have been doing and some journalists have been doing is starting to percolate, is starting to make sense to people who haven't been directly involved.
As a quick just kind of rejoinder somewhat, I would say that's the kind of, and I mean, again, and not to disparage the work that some people are doing, but just to say that, you know, one heard the same things about immigration rights protests in 2004, right? That this was combining all sorts of places, all sorts of kind of dissenting voices in America in regards to incredibly brutal conditions for around immigration. One heard the same thing coming out of the Seattle anti-globalization movement in 1999. And now this is the one that's going to combine. What have we heard from those movements lately in terms, and also I'd also further ask what, again, the kind of, where is any kind of vision of taking power? That is to say, where is the kind of, again, institutions that can mobilize either voters or other forms of actual kind of political power taking? Again, because that movement to me looks like it's losing, that you're speaking of, and losing quite badly.
There is a kind of desperation here, though, isn't there? I mean, on the one hand, we're actually hearing serious politicians speaking in language that I would suggest goes a little bit beyond the usual conciliatory calming of the waters that we sometimes hear. I mean, there has been quite an impassioned appeal for a renewal of trust across warring parties on the 15th of this month. I mean, President Obama, I thought, did something quite remarkable where he was saying, you know, we cannot simply rape, these are my terms, but, you know, we cannot simply strip these communities and send the police in. His language here was really interesting to me. And then send the police in to do the dirty work of containment. I mean, that was prison language that was being used, but on a neighborhood or a citywide scale. So on the one hand, we're hearing politicians using language about rebuilding social trust, about trying to restore or reconcile across these warring lines. And at the same time, you've got these you know, maybe well-intentioned social media campaigns that are, I think, maybe trying to be a little bit too conscious of history. They're hoping that this is their Selma moment, or they're hoping that this is the moment that we'll look back on and say, okay, this is the moment when things changed. But I do wonder, there is a great gap there in the middle, and there is this concern that once the political rhetoric subsides, once the social media campaigns have gone away, what political base, what groundswell of local and political concern has been created to be able to carry this through to the next legislative political level?
Well, I just in response to this, I mean, one of the difficulties that folks are facing is something as straightforward as felon disenfranchisement, right? And so there are institutional acts at play here that concretely disempower people from political participation, along with the just straight up alienation that people have of who am I going to vote for? You know, Tweedledee or Tweedledum, you know, their policies are effectively the same. There are maybe modest variations, but I mean, certainly since the Clinton years, the consequences for the poor in the United States have been virtually the same. And then if you take a slightly longer step back in terms of institution building, one of the things that imprisonment has done, particularly in the post-war period, has been directly an attack on the working class. And so now if you're looking at the forms of institutional organization that have been so important to movement building on the left, I mean, it's being gutted, I mean, in an active process. And so I think it's pretty... to not recognize those active attacks and then to hold the folks who are working quite hard under adversarial conditions to expect greater from them, from us, I should say, those of us who are interested in these sorts of things, that's a big ask without recognizing those processes.
David, are we seeing concrete signs of progress with the demilitarization of local police forces?
We've heard some talk about it, and there's at least an awareness now that this is a problem. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this background, in 1994, amidst actually falling crime rates but a rising concern about new breeds of super criminals in inner cities, Congress actually authorized the transfer of retired military equipment to local police forces. I mean, this is at the end of the Cold War, so there was a feeling there wouldn't be such a need for this weaponry anymore. And with police forces all around the country getting gutted due to funding cuts, this was, you know, widely seen as a viable route to actually re-equipping police forces. As a result, in towns of 15,000, 20,000 people, they have SWAT teams, they have mine-resistant tanks. They have weapons that you use to fight insurgencies in battlefields. And so police are increasingly armed with military-style weapons. Now, I would say that when police look like they're dressed to confront an invading army, a few things happen. First of all, police start treating people like insurgents, if that's what they're equipped to deal with. Second, all kinds of Americans think, if this is how the police are arming themselves, this is how I have to arm myself as well. And the result is an arms race between police and civilians. The more heavily armed civilians get, the more heavily armed criminals get. I think the more police are likely to react with force when they're confronted with an ambiguous situation. And that's frequently what we see in these police shootings. There's some sort of ambiguous situation, there's some kind of situation of threat potentially, and the reaction is to shoot, which often makes a lot of sense considering how heavily armed American society is and the prospect that the other person might be about to shoot as you. So this militarization of the police force has been a huge problem, and it has moved in tandem with the paramilitary turn in American gun culture. This has at least been recognised as a problem. Barack Obama has talked about wanting to end this program of transfer of weapons from militaries to the police. So that's a positive sign. But then there's the problem of, so what are police actually going to do? Because this problem of tax bases collapsing right across the country, of state funding to local government getting cut, which is where a lot of police funding comes from, that problem is not going away. Some of the most popular Republican candidates in the primary, people like Chris Christie, or one of the most formerly popular, someone like Chris Christie, he made his name through slashing city budgets in New Jersey. So I would hope that there'd be a move towards demilitarization. I would hope that maybe this enables Americans to take a step back and say, our police force should not be dressed like this. Our police force shouldn't be armed like this. We shouldn't be sending SWAT teams in to do weed busts, which is an increasingly common kind of phenomenon. I think that this has maybe probably woken people up a bit. One of the most encouraging things that came out of Ferguson was a rising discourse that was very visible on the right as well as the left about these real problems with militarization of the police. That I think increasingly there is some kind of consensus developing on this. In the same way that a lot of people on the conservative side of politics, a lot of Republicans, are now starting to talk about mass incarceration as a problem, and you no longer have people coming out as they would have done in the 80s and the 90s saying that the solution is build more jails. So at the moment we're not seeing any action. But there is an encouraging discourse. I have a sense that I'm probably slightly more willing to look for signs of encouragement than other people on the panel are. But I do see this discourse and the fact that it is bipartisan as at least encouraging.
The United States, the proportion of American citizens that are incarcerated is the stuff of legend.
That's the stuff of reality, unfortunately. Well,
I mean, it's extraordinary to me that one of the developments it seems to me we've been seeing over the last few years is quite explicitly the spilling over of prison-like language, surveillance-like language, into neighborhoods, into streets. Can I just ask the entire panel? I mean, we are on the brink of an election campaign. I mean, you know, the election campaign has already begun. I can't remember the last American election, presidential election, that did not have, that had a let's go softer on law and order, let's go softer on criminals, let's scale back or rethink modes of incarceration. Is there a very real chance that everything that we are going to talk about here is simply going to evaporate in the heat of the election campaign?
Well, I would say even the more important elections in regards to these issues often tend to be local. Yeah, right. And since the 1970s, I mean, prosecutors, police commissioners, prosecutors are always elected, usually in the U.S., criminal judges often elected, police commissioners, mayors, have read the political tea leaves, and again, not in a broad conservative red state America, in the most liberal voting cities in America, and have never lost elections by being harder than their opponent on crime. And by stoking the fears of law and order. I mean, they take that playbook from Ronald Reagan in 1966, but it goes to both parties very quickly. And Clinton perfects it at the Democratic side, and to expect, I suspect, his wife to do much different would be an interesting expectation. But so, I mean, to me, in many ways, again, all the things that David's talking about, these are decided at the local police level. At the local level, sentencing of judges' sentencing has so much to do with this. What prosecutors, what they try to push for, what they prosecute has everything to do with this kind of stuff. And again, with a couple now exceptions in smallish college towns, you are not going to win an election like that. So again, it's not just at the high level.
But the federal level does matter. I mean, it was
The
Violent Crimes Act, Bill Clinton. That was a federal initiative that is, you know, a lot of mass incarceration can be traced to that. So, I mean, you're right at the local level. And, I mean, I think about Phoenix, Arizona, where the sheriff, Joe Arpaio, who his department has also had to pay out millions and millions in wrongful death suits over the years. He's notorious for building outdoor tent prisons and marching prisoners down the street wearing pink underwear. I mean, the guy is an operational fascist. He gets elected with 80% of the vote every time. He's in his 80s now, and he won't retire, because if he retires, he'll immediately be indicted due to corruption in his prisons. His brother runs the vending machine services, which are the only food available. Yeah, he keeps getting re-elected. So, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Dr. David Smith from Sydney University. This is Big Ideas on RN. Paul Barclay with you. We're discussing police violence and protest in America and what it means for Australia. Scott Stevens from RN's The Minefield is your moderator. Back to the discussion with Madeline Pill.
I think Baltimore's a kind of great example of, I guess, the local impacts, though. We're familiar with The Wire, which represented this, but in actuality it was the sort of transition from Mayor Smoke to Mayor O'Malley, and Smoke very much saw the drug issue as one of public health, and he did actually say, if we're going to have a war on drugs, let's make it a public health war and not a war on crime. My personal take on this, I'm very pro a criminologist called David Kennedy, who was at Harvard and is now in New York. He's established a very good reputation amongst several cities in the US, Boston and Minneapolis, for his work with what he calls groups. He doesn't recognise them as gangs. He calls them groups and interventions in group violence and trying to intervene in open-air drug markets. And his logic is quite refreshing in a way from a public policy point of view, because he says we're all so hung up on root causes, and there are so many, and they go so far back. Actually, if we just want to stop the violence, these are some of the things I think we should do. And he's managed to do some of those interventions quite persuasively. With my focus on Baltimore, though, what I find quite sad was in his memoir, which I think is called Don't Shoot, and is a very good read, he kind of singled out Baltimore and the way it was governed as being one of the hardest places that he'd ever tried to work. And he describes in the book going into a meeting with O'Malley, who was the introducer of Comstat, the Giuliani-style kind of zero-tolerance mode of policing in Baltimore, which he then kind of used as a basis to successfully run for governor. But that's as an aside. David Kennedy describes in his memoir going and meeting O'Malley, and O'Malley was reading his post and very much was very offhand with him, and he didn't last very long in Baltimore. Though interestingly, last year he was invited back by the new mayor, Stephanie Rawlins-Blake. But I did notice in the Baltimore Sun a few days ago that the current director of Operation Ceasefire in Baltimore has just resigned. So obviously, I think there were some moves at city level, perhaps to try and do some more innovative approaches, but obviously these were completely subsumed in a kind of police brutality culture, unfortunately.
I wonder, Madeline, can you just talk a little bit more about some of your comparative work in Baltimore and Bristol? I'm also interested in policing, because, of course, police culture in Bristol versus Baltimore would be vastly different. Are there some things that you can kind of bring to the conversation?
I'm afraid I'm not a policing expert. I mean, obviously, if I did have to do a very broad brush comparison, the main one would be that arguably the British police have never been militarised, though, of course, there is an exception to that in terms of the troubles in Northern Ireland and the IEC and so on, which I'm certainly not an expert in discussing. I think the most formative experience in Britain in recent memory in terms of criminal justice was the inquiry into Stephen Lawrence. He was a black teenager that got stabbed in southeast London in the early 90s, murdered. It was a racially motivated murder. And the five people that were kind of initially arrested never got charged. And there was an investigation into the Metropolitan Police's handling of the case and the Crown Prosecution Services, and they were found to be institutionally racist. And this finding had a very significant impact on policing in the UK and led to new legislation. But obviously what we're talking about today, I guess, isn't so pertinent because we haven't seen that kind of heavy equipment on the streets of the UK. In terms of a comparison of Bristol and Baltimore, the main lens for me in terms of my interest was how the city governed its deprived neighbourhoods and how those deprived neighbourhoods had a voice at city level in the policies that were being developed for them and how those policies were implemented. And obviously, if you make that comparison, it was useful because Baltimore has been undergoing, in European terms, decades of austerity. And so it was potentially a source, a potential harbinger, if you like, of the future in Bristol and other UK cities. Since I did my research, I actually did it around the time of the Great Recession. So I was in Baltimore 2007, 2008, and I'm returning there later this year. So it'll be interesting to see how those neighbourhood initiatives that I worked with then, how things have changed, if for good or ill, in the interim. But what's happened subsequently to the recession in Bristol is that deprived neighbourhood targeted initiatives have been very much had their funding cut. The state has withdrawn from those neighbourhoods, and to use the sort of the academic terminology myself and my co-author developed, we kind of posited a conjuncture of self-help having arisen, which in the coalition government that was elected in 2010 was termed the big society. So you cut state services, but civil society is capable of stepping into the breach of self-provision of social services. What I saw in Baltimore was that much further advanced, but actually, of course, communities weren't really able to self-help. They were very much reliant on the largesse of institutions present in that neighbourhood or with an interest in it, if they existed. So a big example would be the big governor, as I would argue, in Baltimore, which is Johns Hopkins University, which is not only the biggest employer in the city, but in the whole state of Maryland. So a lot of the economic development strategies of the city hinge on what this institution does and its ambitions, for example, for biomedical development of that area of the economy. So in Baltimore, when I was doing my research, there was a very large set of neighbourhoods in East Baltimore, proximate to part of Johns Hopkins, that were comprehensively redeveloped. They were knocked down and the residents were relocated with the help of a locally based foundation, the Casey Foundation. So to an extent, one could argue that those residents, perhaps their life chances were improved in terms of moving perhaps to neighbourhoods of opportunity. You know, that this is another federal policy, the Moving to Opportunity Programme, a kind of a mixed neighbourhoods ethos and so on, neighbourhood effects. But they could only achieve perhaps possibly better outcomes and better housing by going along with what had been proposed for their neighbourhood. They were completely disempowered and kind of co-opted into the city and the institution, Johns Hopkins' vision for that neighbourhood. That's an extreme compared to the Bristol experience, but I think it's a salutary lesson of the need for some kind of caring state provision.
In regards to American cities, well, not just American cities in general, that kind of program, I mean, gets its legs under Bill Clinton and his Hope 6 program, which is essentially the destruction of the right to housing in America and the end of the kind of post-World War II, essentially Harry Truman era, more or less, at least kind of theoretical guarantor of a right to housing. Further, I would just add that all decent social science research that I've come across on Hope 6 and on these mixed income has found that the actual number of housing units that gets built is far lesser than had previously existed in most of these places, and two, that any kind of outcomes, as said, are not better by any means. And in a case like Baltimore, and Hopkins is the classic example, along with Columbia, New York, along with the University of Chicago, and Chicago, to some extent USC and LA, of the relationship between a large private university stuck in the middle of a predominantly African-American poor neighborhoods, and their relationship to especially kind of rent intensification in the areas surrounding them, but also in their relationship to the militarization of police themselves. And campus police in America are armed. They have arrest powers. And in places like Hopkins, Chicago, they exercise those powers very frequently. And I think as bad as a lot of American metropolitan police departments are, anecdotally, a lot of campus police departments are even worse in these regards, because again, they're very much protecting a brand which is built upon the safety of their students, supposedly, which very much means more or less a long history dating back at least to the 1930s of clearing out the neighborhood surrounding them of any elements that are seen as criminal, which is generally code for black.
One of the theorists, I must confess, that sort of haunts me constantly in these sorts of conversations is Hannah Arendt. She was surprisingly skeptical of the power, the durability of some of the civil rights protests and forms of civil disobedience in the early 60s to early 70s. And one of the reasons that she was pessimistic was that she regarded that one of the things that had taken place within American society had been the gradual erosion of the ability to join together for common cause, to organize together for some common goal. In other words, to embody the very essence of political action. It just strikes me that sort of 40, 50 years hence, one of the effects of this incarceral culture, one of the effects of mass imprisonment and the wiping out, the redevelopment of entire communities, is the atomization, the individualization, the being left to their own devices without forms, not even so much of sort of government welfare or political help, but the basic social stuff of organization and being able to pursue together some kind of good in common. I mean, Ethan, is there a kind of base of the very possibility of political action that's simply been eroded away?
I'm not entirely sure how to answer that because, I mean, on the one hand, prisons are actively geared toward the dissolution of solidarities.
Yes.
I mean, there are specific control strategies around preventing people from organizing in any way, shape, or form that is contrary to the guard's power, right? So they actively pursue this through spatial organization, through the creation of hierarchies, through labor assignment, by stoking racial fighting amongst prisoners. They're sharp. They know what they're doing, and they do it. I mean, at the same time, when you've got the retraction of a legitimate form of state and a legitimate form of governance, it also gives rise to other alternative forms of organization. And so, I mean, I don't want to take this too far, but I mean, there are some arguments that when the state withdraws its role of legitimate governance, it gives rise for the possibility for criminal gangs to grow, take shape, control the drug trade, and so on. Now, the reason why I don't want to go too far with that is because oftentimes right now, as prisoners are organizing, legitimately organizing and conducting hunger strikes about the overuse of solitary confinement, they are being accused of being gang members. Right, and they're not necessarily gang members. I mean, what can quite often happen, not to say that there are no gang members, because of course there are, but what can quite frequently happen is that the folks who are doing the organizing, you know, they are disruptive, they're causing problems, they're messing with the system, and they get put into ADSEG, or to solitary confinement again. And so at the same time that you do have these specific processes of atomization and the destruction of communities, which some scholars call a proto-genocidal policy, I mean, I don't know that I would go that far, but some people are making these arguments. And I think these are worthwhile arguments to pursue. You see people still, despite this, trying to organize and still trying to create political movements and actually doing so remarkably well. I mean, the hunger strikes in California, I'm not sure how many folks around here heard about them, but they were real. I mean, prisoners were organizing, and the strike was spreading through the prison. I mean, what's remarkable is you can organize from a solitary confinement cell. And that, to me, is a remarkable statement about the possibility of opposing forms of control.
Ethan, I mean, as much as, I mean, I agree completely, and that is incredibly impressive, though, isn't the end game of that simply a better form of imprisonment? Right? Less solitary confinement, more freedoms while in prison. Isn't the end game of that a kind of broad, at its best, a long battle to make the prison industrial state slightly more just in its execution?
No. No, it isn't. I think there are broad political strategies that people are engaged in right now. And the kinds of movement building that is taking place are diverse, they're complicated, they're contradictory. But the one of the broad forms of movement right now, one of the banners that people are organizing around is through a notion of what they call prison abolition. Right? And the concept of prison abolition draws from the notion, well, first of all, it draws concrete historical linkages to slavery, right? The folks who hated slavery, first and foremost the slaves, but then also their allies tried to get rid of slavery, and they were known as abolitionists. Okay, so what prison abolitionists and what prison abolitionism means today is that the prison itself cannot be reformed. The prison was born of reform, right, in the early modern period. And so the prison, prior to there being a prison, if you offend the king, he'll pull your arms off and then pour, hot oil down your neck and, do have all of these horrible, horrible tortures.
I think you could get elected in a Republican primary for Congress these days on bringing that back.
I don't doubt it. But the thing is, so the very premise of the prison was itself as a kind of reform, right? We will give you time to reflect, to be penitent. This is the root of the word penitentiary. And so, but what has happened is over the course of the last 200 odd years, the fundamental violence that the king wielded upon those who offended the king has never disappeared, but more layers of control have been added on it. So every time there's been a reform, prison labor to teach people trades, this quickly becomes another form of unfree labor in the convict lease period, right? To re-enslave Africans or African Americans. There are new the use of pharmacological controls, the use of spatial controls, the use of all sorts of different ways of killing, frankly, so that the move from, instead of hanging somebody from the neck till they're dead to putting them in the electric chair, right? This is a prison reform. Okay? How satisfactory is this? So anyway, the notion of prison abolition is one move that people are making that says, look, we can't reform these institutions. We need to look to a future where we don't even have prisons. And on the one hand, it's a utopian vision, right? It's a utopian vision, but on the other hand, the idea is that we need to first be able to imagine another world before we can work towards it. Other folks who are working in much more concrete ways, with an abolition, with abolition as a horizon that we walk towards, but who are trying to take more concrete steps towards decarceration is the name for this movement right now.
Paul Barclay here. This is Big Ideas on RN and online. You're listening to a discussion on police violence and protest in America and what it means for Australia, hosted by the US Studies Centre at Sydney Uni. Back to Scott Stevens.
One of the reasons that we are all here is because Australia, it struck me from when I first moved here 20 some odd years ago, there is a kind of fetishistic fascination with American politics, with the grotesqueries of the American theater, by which I mean politics. One of the things, though, that often concerns me is that this kind of fascination from abroad, the watching of the sheer spectacle in Ferguson, the sheer spectacle in Baltimore, becomes so fascinating that it almost numbs us to some extent to our own social, political complicity, particularly here. David, I wonder, is there, without making a kind of, mercilessly convenient segue, there are lessons. There are absolutely sort of things that ought to be sort of brought home. But I just wonder, what are we missing closer to home because of how intently we are captured by the spectacle overseas?
Yeah, in terms of this general point, one thing I've learned, and I think I'm the only Australian-born person on the panel, having lived in the US, having a lot of relatives in England, is that when you're a white person in a white-dominated society, the other country's white domination is always worse than yours. In Britain and even in the United States, Australia is often a shorthand for horrific racism. But yet, when sort of our mental model of racism here is often the U.S. South. I was shocked by things, you know, that I heard just in casual conversation in Britain, and I think that we always tend to see structures of racial domination in other countries far more clearly than we see our own, and we're often far more likely to rationalise our own structures of racial domination. So the fact that there are Aboriginal communities in the United States who live in conditions that are basically like pre-civil rights African-American communities in the South, the fact that there have been 340 black deaths in custody since the Royal Commission in 1987, I don't know, I think that sometimes we don't see that as part of the same kind of class of problem. I think that, you know, countries can learn lessons from each other. Looking at the riots happening in Baltimore and seeing a lot of commentators here in the United States and other places in the world saying, look, we sympathize with you, but, you know, rioting never works, trashing your own neighborhood never works. That's not true. Sometimes it does. It doesn't always work. So two examples from Australia, the Palm Island riots after the death of Cameron Dumaji. That didn't achieve anything. That meant that various rioters got sent to prison for a number of years while the police officers who were involved in the death were acquitted. But the riot that happened in Redfern, and I'm trying to remember the year now, I think it was around 2003. I was an undergraduate here at the time, after the death of TJ Hickey. That was just decried at the time as this is just pointless destruction. A lot of the rhetoric that was coming out was this wasn't even a protest. This was a bunch of drug dealers getting together and wreaking havoc. But as Larissa Berendt pointed out in a piece that she wrote on Ferguson, one of the things that actually happened as a result of that was a major change in policing in Redfern. The station commander changed, the entire approach changed, and there was far less arbitrary incarceration of Aboriginal men after that event. Things actually did really materially improve in Redfern, and part of that was because a riot took place that actually seriously drew attention. So once again, you never know which riot is going to achieve something and which isn't. But that Redfern example is actually one of where something was achieved.
Mm-hmm. And, so, you know, I would just add, too, the 92 L.A. riots basically got a change of the change of the police chief of L.A., which, again, LAPD being the kind of classic case of American militarized policed, made things slightly better.
Can I just flesh out the specific example of the police? Because the way that police are regarded here is vastly different from the way that police are regarded in the United States. In the United States, police are not just one of the top three trusted institutions within American public life, but they are also, I mean, they are the agents of majoritarian will. Here, it's not the same.
I would disagree, I think, with that. African Americans do not trust the police, just
no,
period.
No.
But I would say the vast majority, my father taught me to be scared of guns, period, whether they were carried by the police or carried by other people, right? And I think that is a common perception amongst many Americans, and that there is not this kind of blanket goodwill towards the police that exists, I think. And it exists in a kind of broad cultural sense. You see it after 9/11 and things like that, but at the broad level, I don't think it's necessarily that.
Mm-hmm. What about here more specifically? The institution of the police as such?
How are they regarded?
Hmm.
As Madeline pointed out with Britain, the police here, even though they carry weapons, are nowhere near as heavily militarized as they are in the United States. And I think in the United States, part of that perception of the police that you talked about comes from more of a sense that if we don't have the police here, chaos is going to break out at any moment. I think that perception is quite different in Australia. And I think that's why Australians don't want to see police any more heavily armed than they already are. And I think, I mean, police, I think, are a trusted profession here, are a respected profession here, but there's not the same sense of seeing them in almost this kind of military role. And part of the militarization of police in the United States, it's not just because of this congressional weapons transfer, but it's backed by rhetoric as well about how, you know, the police are the only thing standing between the citizenry and violent people who want to do us harm and chaos. And I think that the perception of that in Australia is a little bit different. I think there's not so much of a there's not so much of a sense of the thin blue line is all there is between us and a war of all against all.
The other point of connection that's very, very important, of course, are incarceration rates, especially in Northern Territory and Western Australia, which outstrip the U.S.
Aboriginal folks are radically disproportionately incarcerated. I mean, the conditions are much more are much closer to the kind of hyper incarceration and the hyper racialized incarceration that we see in the U.S. And in the
with
in
the same social effects.
In terms of cultural destruction,
yes.
And I think if we can step back a bit, one of the things to think about is the different ways that imprisonment is working right now in relationship to different historical forms of settler colonialism and capital accumulation. So right now, I mean, one of the driving forces for mass imprisonment of largely African Americans, but not just African Americans. I mean, there are many, many reasons, but the political economic, one of the main political economic reasons is that to absorb a surplus labor population, if I can be kind of Marxist-y for a minute. But with deindustrialization, there's all sorts of people who don't have jobs or for whom there are no jobs, and so they get drawn into this prison state, this carceral state. The dynamic is a little bit different. The dynamic is different here in that I think it's much more closely tied to the settler colonial process of absorbing land and of claiming land for Australia or claiming land more pointedly for multinational mining interests. Now, in terms of the effect on Aboriginal communities. I mean, I'm a scholar of the United States, right? Not of Australia. So my work on for the Deaths in Custody Watch Committee is what I do in the weekends and evenings. But the effects of, first of all, being displaced from communities. I mean, this is the real form of cultural destruction that is being forced upon Aboriginal folks, and then that they're striving mightily to resist and to survive against. But then, as folks are imprisoned, the forms of, the stresses this puts on Aboriginal communities are massive. And I mean, when you're looking at Western Australia, if people are imprisoned or are locked up from remote communities, commonly for fine default, for driving without a license, for really inconsequential acts, right? You get locked up, you get driven a very, 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 very long way away from your country and from your family and from your community. Now, a concrete way that this disrupts Aboriginal families is around what happens when somebody dies. And I'm not talking about the prisoner, I mean, which happens altogether too much. But if a family member dies and you're locked up, you are culturally obligated to go and be with your family. And if you can't go, then you are violating law. And this will create all sorts of new disruption, new dislocation, all sorts of new difficulties within communities. And I mean, there have been back and forth arguments about how far the various private contracting firms are willing to drive people to visit family members for a funeral. And of course, the private firms are saying, oh, we don't want to drive so far because it'll be too expensive. And so, I mean, that's a very specific way that communities are being disrupted. Not to mention, you know, you get locked up, you can't be with your kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in the US, a discourse around absent fathers has, ever since 1964, ever since the Moynihan Report, so for more than 50 years, it's been commonplace to blame problems in African American communities on absent fathers. And that's often just framed in terms of general irresponsibility, men just not taking irresponsibility. But obviously, mass incarceration feeds into this hugely. And yeah, there's a lot of talk about absent fathers creating crime and being responsible for mass incarceration, but quite clearly, the cause is going the other way around as well. I remember hearing a few years ago a news report how in Philadelphia, polygamy in some African-American communities had reemerged as a sort of totally acceptable and legally tolerated form of social organization because of the male shortage in these communities. Now, yes, it's, and there's, I mean, there's, I do remember hearing things in Aboriginal Australia as well about, yeah, lack of male role models. When 2% of the general population is Aboriginal, but 25% of the prison population is Aboriginal, and that's overwhelmingly male, you can see that the mass incarceration is going to contribute to that.
I mean, I can't speak to America, but or to Australia in this regard too much, although I did want to try to talk about the intervention at some point in relation to the shift to some of this stuff. But I mean, I think that, you know, what David was referring to in the Monaghan report and this kind of broader lack of, as the sociologist William Julius Wilson famously called it, marriageable black men. I mean, frankly, has been a key part of the broader ideological justification for the decimation of the American welfare state and the programs that have helped. And again, close social science analysis has generally argued this is BS, right? That, I mean, these are all, to the extent that these things exist as problems, they exist as completely symptomatic of other things. And again, this doesn't, it's not simply involving kind of a lack of man communities, right? This is drug use, this is alcohol abuse, this is, it often takes the form of the way people talk, right, that as indicative of causation of their poverty, right, the way talking in slang therefore means you're not employable, all these kinds of BS type things. And, you know, that has fed itself over and over and over again. And, you know, when the American, when Barack Obama, you know, I was talking a lot about this stuff, and Australians, again, kind of asked me this question of how is it that under an American president this kind of stuff is happening? And, I mean, it's an absurd question. African-American president, it's an absurd question on its face, but also under this president who went, did his kind of presidential, in a great kind of moment, in his first year in office, he goes to the NAACP, which, with the exception of George W. Bush, American presidents have traditionally do every year, and goes to the national convention. And he proceeds to tell this 98% black audience to stop eating as much fried chicken as they're eating, because they're making their communities fat. And that's more or less the key aspect of his speech, that their behavior is the pathology that's driving all these problems, not the massive disinvestment in education, not the kind of massive militarization of police, but again, individualized behavior. And I mean, so to kind of get at that, I don't know, anything that starts to talk of death of role models, lack of marriageable men, things like that, tends to, I think, bring us down. And this is the case of America, I think, is showing a really, really dark road. To me, it's amazing coming here from America for a little more than a year now that my understanding is that Australia, and some of this is just the nature of a lack of a constitutional system, but not having equal protection under the law as a kind of basic aspect, right? I mean, America has equal protection under the law since 1868. Many states just chose to pass all sorts of unconstitutional laws. But in 1965, America at least makes it largely a juridical level, makes states stop being unconstitutional. But the fact that Howard Wright can just suspend the Racial Discrimination Act at his own choosing seems to me against the very nature of a Racial Discrimination Act and its purpose. So, I mean, again, this is just as someone from outside coming in, but I just don't understand how that can even exist.
Thomas Adams ending that discussion on police violence and protest in America, what it means for Australia. You also heard from Ethan Blue from the University of Western Australia, Madeline Pill and David Smith from the University of Sydney. Scott Stevens from RN's The Minefield was the host. I'm Paul Barclay. Until tomorrow night, bye for now.
Since the devastating earthquakes in Nepal, now more than ever, the Nepalese need the money that their workers are sending home from abroad.
Foreign employment has gave me the courage, you know, that you can do something.
So it boosted your confidence?
Yes.
But not everyone's story is a positive one.
They feel ashamed to tell the whole story, so they will just tell you the good part.
Risks and rewards in Nepal. That's Workers Without Borders, online at the RN homepage.